Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, creator of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, a freelance writer focused on food and health.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessed home cooks everywhere. This week we're talking about black-eyed peas with Ethiopian spices, soft-boiled eggs, and cleaning our pots and pans. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. So I found this article the week before the Super Bowl, so it's a little bit out of date now, but the Super Bowl is one of the biggest holidays for guacamole. You know, who knew it was the biggest weekend in America for guacamole?
That makes sense, though.
It totally does. And so it's all about how there's a company that's developing these little like sachets to pack with produce that emit chemicals that counteract the natural ripening agents that produce emits, which I thought was fascinating.
So in theory, you put the little packet in with your box of avocados, and then the avocados do not start to ripen until they are separated from it.
Yes.
Which, okay, that sounds like it might be useful, but I don't see how it has to do. I think the headline is misleading.
Yes.
It's not going to keep your guacamole fresher.
No. Yeah, the headline is your guacamole will be fresher this weekend, which I don't think is actually true, but your avocados maybe will have less brown spots.
Right.
But, you know, they don't indicate what chemicals they're using. They don't talk about, like, what's the resulting moisture loss that's happening because, mm-hmm. like, they're counteracting, like, the ethylene gases that are the produce is emitting.
Yeah.
But they're not talking about, like, how are they compensating for the natural moisture loss.
I wonder how it affects the ultimate deliciousness of the avocado.
Yeah, I don't know how it would affect the deliciousness. But I've certainly had avocados that were sort of almost like – clayey, and I wonder if that's the result.
Maybe.
Because a good avocado should always be creamy.
Mm-hmm.
I've also had avocados in the past that look perfect on the outside but are just completely rotten and brown on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, were they exposed to this process? I don't know.
You may recall this summer I did this gigantic avocado recipe development project where I purchased, I don't know, like $1,000 worth of avocados in a month's time. So I feel like I've seen every possible variation on avocado ripeness.
Yeah.
And a disturbing number of avocados seem to get rotten before they become ripe.
Yes.
I wonder, maybe something.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like you and I are both technology skeptics when it comes to food, I think.
That is true.
So we both give this like, you know, a wait and see.
Yeah. I have a little side eye for this.
Yeah.
Really?
But I mean, if the end result is fewer spoiled avocados, that's all for the best.
And less food waste overall, then I'm all for it. It's just...
But usually the problem is not too many ripe avocados at the supermarket. Usually the problem is like
there are
too much unripe. Like you have to buy an avocado days in advance of when you want to use it.
Yeah, I know. It's a problem.
It's a whole lifestyle. Avocado ripening lifestyle. And I still, even though I'm done with that project, I love avocados. I think they're like such a wonderful... snack, salad addition, good on a sandwich. Guacamole, obviously, is wonderful.
I have an avocado confession to make.
Sure.
I bought a bunch of avocados because they were all on sale for the Super Bowl.
Uh-oh.
And so earlier this week, when I was not feeling well, I have a cold, I made myself guacamole for lunch, and I just ate chips and guacamole by myself.
That sounds like a great lunch to me.
It was amazing. I ignored my babies and let them play and kind of grouse on the floor while I ate this bowl of guacamole.
Well, avocados are a tremendously nutritious food.
It's true.
It's not like it was like some kind of nutritionally bankrupt lunch you had.
I know. I just feel like guacamole is something to be shared, not something to like starve by yourself in the half light of, you know, winter afternoon, and you're, you know, with two children playing this nearby.
It was guac o'clock for you. What could you do?
It was. I needed it. I needed it. That's all I can say.
Well, we'll post the link to this news item as always. And I guess we'll see what happens to the avocados as a result of this new, brave new technology.
We shall see. So I want you to tell us all about this black-eyed peas dish. And I say this having smelled it once.
Yeah, the last time we recorded, I had just made it because I had stuff to do later in the day. I planned to have this dish for dinner, and I just wanted to have it like done and ready so that I could go out and do whatever I needed to do and then come home and it would be done.
It smelled so good.
It is a tremendously good smelling dish.
Yeah. Did it taste as good as it smelled?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It is Marcus Samuelson's black-eyed peas with coconut milk and Ethiopian spices. The Ethiopian spices in question are the, you know, the Burberry blend, or yeah. Is it Berber? I don't actually know.
I don't know how to
pronounce
it.
It's spelled Berbere.
Yeah.
I thought I would have trouble tracking it down, but I found it at the first place I looked.
Great.
So I think it's probably more common than you would imagine. It also is full of ginger, chili, garlic. It's like, and then of course, coconut milk makes it incredibly creamy and wonderful. As we all know, I am a smug member of the Rancho Gordo Bean Club. And one of the privileges of membership is being in the Rancho Gordo Bean Club Facebook group, where recipes are frequently praised and panned and passed around. But this recipe was getting more attention than anything I had seen to date, even more attention than the famous pizza beans, which we have discussed in our previous episode.
Wow, that's really saying something, because those pizza beans are famous.
People were raving about this recipe. And I have to say, as the recipe is written, I don't think you have to cook the black-eyed peas from dried. I think you can use a can of black-eyed peas.
Oh, interesting.
And so I finally made it, and it exceeded my expectations. Did you ever have something where it was very hyped for whatever reason, and you made it, and it was kind of a letdown?
Yes.
This was not that.
I'm so glad.
It was so good.
Well, and you deserved a bean win like that, or a pea win, because you've made some things recently where the beans themselves were better than the combined dish.
That's true. And I do love the taste of black-eyed peas, but in this situation, like, this coconutty, spicy sauce was so, like, and it's finished with, like, cilantro. I mean, my mouth is watering just thinking about it. We served it with rice, but it would be, I think, incredible with injera, which is that spongy Ethiopian bread that I do not know how to make or know where to buy.
Yeah, you have to ferment the like teff flour batter, and it feels like a big commitment.
That would be so good, though.
Yeah, I bet it would be.
Or even naan, I think, would be good with it. But rice was fine.
Yeah.
It made a ton. I put a bunch of servings in my freezer. I think I have one more left still. And I will absolutely make it again.
Yeah.
With one little change. I'm going to try to substitute cashew cream for the coconut milk, because coconut milk is very high in saturated fat, and I've been trying to like really cut back on saturated fat. So
yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. And I'm sure that you'll lose a little bit of that coconut flavor, but it sounds like the spices will really carry the day.
It is really assertive in the spice department. Yeah. I made it really spicy, and I think next time I make it even more spicy. Dan is always telling me to like remove the seeds, you know, because he's a little bit of a spice wimp. But I really like to go all in on the spice. So I don't know if this is something that would go over in your house. I'm thinking probably not.
Scott's not really into coconut. So if I did a variation, I would try your coconut or your cashew cream idea. But, you know, he's not really into anything spicy either. So it might be.
Maybe I'll just make it for the two of us sometime.
That sounds good, because it smelled good when I was here. And, you know, I certainly can make things that he's not going to eat. But it's not as much fun to make a whole pot of something if I don't have someone to share it with.
I know what you mean. I'm making stuffed cabbage this weekend, even though Dan does not like it. And I'm like, I'm sorry, make something else. Eat it and just like accept that you're going to eat a dinner that you don't love.
Yeah.
Or like cook something else. I don't care. I love stuffed cabbage. I didn't make it at all last winter. I'm making it.
God, I love stuffed cabbage. It always reminds me of my mom used to make it like twice a year when I was growing up, and she'd make it the night before and layer it in a slow cooker and then let it cook all day. And we'd come home and the house would smell like, you know, I think she's turkey, ground turkey. And so you get that meaty, cabbagey, tomatoey, like just warm steam smell in the house. So good.
I've made it with no meat at all before.
Yeah.
This time I'm going to try some Trader Joe's unbeef, like there are no beef, ground beef.
Oh, interesting.
Which I've read on the internet is very tasty. I've never had it. I do like their soy chorizo a lot. Yeah. So we'll see.
I'm excited to hear.
I'll report back.
So let's switch from black-eyed peas and, you know, long simmered beans to talk about something that's quick and easy to make and is one of my favorite things right now.
Lay it on me.
It's a soft-boiled egg. You know, they're so good.
You do have a touch with the eggs. You taught me how to do poached eggs after a lifetime of really struggling.
Yeah, I am. And so here, there's also a little bit of rant in this, because I So there's a lot of talk on the internet right now and in the food world, the food Instagram particularly, about jammy eggs. You know what I'm talking about. Like, people always talk about, like, serve this with a jammy egg. And essentially, a jammy egg is a soft-boiled egg that has been rebranded. And I find it a little irritating that we have to, one, take the word jam and apply it to something that is nowhere near jam. We all know I have particular feelings about jam, and jam is a fruit-based thing. And what's wrong with just calling it what it is, which is a soft-boiled egg?
I actually have a different understanding of what a jammy egg is.
What is it?
I think it is a hard-boiled egg, but one that is cooked less so the yolk is not so set.
And that is a soft-boiled egg.
I thought in a soft-boiled egg, the whites were more quivery.
So here's the thing with a soft-boiled egg. There is a wide spectrum of soft-boiled eggs, and eggs are soft-boiled until they're hard-boiled.
I thought a soft-boiled egg was a thing that you put in that special little cup and, like, you use the special little tool to cut the shell and then you take the little spoon and you – or the toast soldiers and you eat. And I've never eaten this or made it, but this is –
I mean, that's how some people eat soft-boiled eggs. But a soft-boiled egg is simply an egg that is – it's like a poached egg. It's cooked, but it's cooked in the shell. And so it is an egg that is – you bring a pot of water to a boil.
But a poached egg's white is wobbly.
Well, but – it doesn't have to be. So, I mean, there's a wide spectrum of poached eggs, too, depending on your preference. But a soft-boiled egg is any egg that's cooked in water in its shell. And then if you cook it more than 10 minutes, then it crosses the line to hard-boiled. But it's just – so, like, I find when it comes to soft-boiled eggs that the 7-minute egg, for my preference, is perfect. But basically, you know, there's just – you cook it 4 minutes and the whites will be – just barely set. You cook it 6 minutes, you're still going to have just a quiver in the white. 7 minutes, to me, the white is fully cooked, but the internal, you've still got some kind of goo going on in
the
yolk.
Does it flow? The yolk?
No, it's more like a, it doesn't flow, but it's like spreadable. Like, you could kind of take it and spread it on a piece of toast or something. Uh-huh. But yeah, so like a jammy egg is a term that has kind of catapulted in, parachuted in to a long accepted range of timings for a soft-boiled egg, and has been co-opted the category. Hmm. And I find this very irritating. I realize I might be alone here, but a jammy egg is a soft-boiled egg. That they are one and the same. So anyway,
I'm not in the business of eggs anymore.
I know,
so
you're not.
I can't get too worked up about it. But why don't you also give us your wisdom and expertise, and how do you make the soft-boiled egg? Do you start with a refrigerator egg, or has it come to room temperature?
Who has the time for their eggs to come to room temperature, really?
I don't know, but this is definitely part of the conversation about cooking eggs.
I never take the time to bring eggs to room temperature, whether I'm baking. I mean, sometimes if I'm baking, it's a really fussy recipe. I will put it in a bowl of warm water for a couple of minutes.
Do you put the egg into the water before you boil it, or do you boil the water and then add
you
the
boil,
egg?
So you bring a pot of water to a boil. It is bubbling away. You take a slotted spoon and you lower your eggs into it. And then once the eggs are in the pot, you set a timer immediately. And so for me, I like a 7-minute egg. If you want the yolk a little bit, you know, more well done, you go 8 minutes. If you want it a little less, you go 6 minutes. There's some really beautiful pictures on the internet that will show you the full spectrum of what the yolks look like at each, like 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, mm-hmm. so that you can go and decide what your perfect egg is. Once your timer goes off, you take those eggs out of the water again with your slotted spoon. And, you know, some people might say put them in a bowl of ice water.
To stop the cooking.
Yeah, but who's got time for that? I just run it under hot water, cold water from the tap for, 30 seconds. And then you crack the shell and it should pull away. You want to have enough, you want it to be cooked enough so that it holds its shape. And then you cut it in half and you let it ooze over whatever you've made. Recently I had, Scott was playing, it was a Friday night, the babies were asleep, Scott was off playing D&D, and I made a little pot of rice, and I sauteed some broccoli, and I made 2 soft-boiled eggs. And so I cut the eggs open over this jasmine rice and let the yolks kind of just goo into the rice, and ate it with the broccoli, and it was delicious.
Are they more difficult to peel at a 7-minute mark?
No, I find them really easy to peel. They're easier to peel. A soft-boiled egg's easier to peel than a hard-boiled egg.
That seems counterintuitive.
I know, but it's not. Okay. I mean, I don't know why it is, but there's just more movement still.
Do you have any of that fuss budget stuff with the cup and the cutter?
God, no.
No. I don't. I've seen it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that I've certainly seen it too, like in like British breakfast situations. But growing up, like, and I think part of the reason I have such strong feelings is that so often people take things that I grew up with that were just part of our normal cooking and they make a big fuss out of it. Same goes with poached eggs. Like I grew up just put a skillet on the stove. You bring water to a simmer. You break your eggs in. You let them cook for a few minutes and they're done. And there was never any ceremony or fuss over the eggs in my household. And like now we live in an era where it's like there's all this fuss about a jammy egg and there's all this fuss about poached eggs. It's just egg cooking. Whether it's, you know, one thing or another, if you can scramble an egg, you can poach an egg. And when I was a kid, my mom would make cream of wheat with soft boiled eggs on top with lots of salt. And it was so delicious. And so for me, there's just this very, nostalgic, evocative feel to those soft boiled eggs as well.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yes. Sorry. I got a little heated about soft boiled eggs there, guys, but I have strong feelings.
That definitely expands my understanding because I did not think that, a jammy egg and a soft boiled egg were one and the same.
I think that you probably wouldn't even have heard, you would not be able to find the term jammy egg in food writing 10 years ago. Like it was not a concept. It's simply rebranding something that is age old.
Yeah. Well, obviously the eggs are not changing. So the way we talk about them perhaps needs to in order to
perhaps
engage an Instagram audience.
So I wanted to talk about cleaning pots and pans. And the reason is that, in my childhood, my mom is a very aggressive cleaner. So I was trained to really scrub the hell out of things, you know, so like any pot shouldn't have any trace of cooking residue on it when it gets put away. And you know, so it's like my mom's stainless steel always gleamed. There wasn't any sort of like, you know, patina or staining on the outside. And in fact, my mother ruined a set of Le Creuset in my childhood because she would bleach them because she couldn't stand the stains. So understanding that that's the perspective that I come from, I realized recently that I was stressing far too much about the cleanliness of my pots and pans, that I didn't have to scrub every trace of cooking off of them, for them to be considered clean. And it has liberated me. It has freed me up to, one, make things that will leave a trace. So like one of my favorite things to cook when it comes to broccoli is doing the thing where you get this like the cast iron pot screaming hot, you get the broccoli wet, a little layer of olive oil, throw the wet broccoli in, and then kind of let it, it's almost like a plancha, like sear. So you get this really kind of blistered, wonderful seared broccoli. And I wouldn't do it often because of the scrubbing that went into cleaning the pot. And lately I have just given up and I have let the marks stay on the pot. And it, one, makes my life easier, and two, makes me make that broccoli more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good thing.
And so I was just curious, like, what is your perspective on this? Do you scrub everything to, you know, factory settings essentially?
Well, first I have to say, for the most part, I just like refuse to do dishes and Dan does them. So actually I had to ask him this morning what he does with certain things. We have Le Creusets and they look pristine not because we're such aggressive cleaners, but because we have an induction cooktop and things, you know, it really leave your pans spotless. Yeah. Like they do not scorch. You know, it's much easier to keep pots and pans, clean that way.
Yeah.
But, also Dan does hit them with like a little Bonamy or whatever.
Yeah.
Not like, I mean, he's not going crazy like a maniac. I think it is mostly the induction, but, and also I haven't been searing broccoli or anything in those pots. So they look, both of them, one is very old. It looks great. It has like some marks due to our pre-induction life, but it still looks very young for its age.
Yeah.
And Dan got me a new one for my birthday in May last year. It looks brand new.
Wow.
So there's that. The thing that I asked Dan not to touch is my carbon steel pans.
Yeah.
And how I clean those is, I don't really clean them. If there's residue, like when the thing, I've scraped it out of the pan and then maybe I'll like get a plastic scraper and try to like scrape off anything else. And then if there's residue after that, I burn it off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I put it over a high heat on the stove. And then when it's, I let it smoke, you know, I fill the whole house up with smoke. And then I will put olive, or not olive oil, like canola oil on a old dish towel. And then I'll buff it and like wipe that, like the ash away. Sometimes I'll add a little salt if it needs some abrasion. Because I feel like that's the only way. I mean, carbon steel is more delicate than cast iron. Like, if you get water on there, like, or if you put soap in there, you're going to have to re-season. Go back, you know, and re-season. So yeah, that's been what I've been doing.
And do you feel like your carbon steel pans are really nonstick these days?
I feel like they're getting there. I feel like this is going to be a years long process. And of course, every once in a while, something happens. Like, Dan put a steamy lid on one of my carbon steel pans and they rust so quickly. So like that one had to be re-seasoned, you know? But yeah, I mostly don't wash those at all. Like cooking residue is what makes them good.
Yeah.
And, I don't know what Dan does with this, what do you call the heavier stuff? Like, cast iron. He deals with that also.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still a scrubber, but as I think about moving to a more kind of environmentally sound kitchen, one of the things I realize I'm going to need to give up soon are my like disposable super scrubby sponges. Because I love a super, like there's a purple sponge that, I think Scotch-Brite makes that is like super duper scrubby and it really makes your stainless steel shine, but they don't last very long. You know, they maybe last a month and then I have to chuck it and you get a new one. And I'm feeling like I need to be more environmentally sound when it comes to my cleaning tools.
So what will you replace it with?
Well, I've seen a lot of people shifting to like a really kind of burly chunk of bar soap and a scrub brush for their kitchen dish needs. And I was thinking about doing that because that removes both the plastic and the sponge. So you don't have like liquid soap that then you're throwing out a bunch of bottles. But it won't have that satisfying scrubbiness.
I wonder, you'll have to tell us if that works.
Yeah.
I don't know if I feel like I just have a gut feeling that it wouldn't work as well, but I don't know. Maybe it will.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I, you know, in making steps to be more environmentally friendly, that is one thing that I can do. But I'm loath to give up my disposable super scrubby sponge. I think that I need to become someone who is more okay with like an external patina on their pans. And if I'm able to do that, maybe I'll also have greater peace with the fact that Scott never washes the outside of pans when he washes them.
Yeah, you've mentioned that before.
And so,
that's a funny thing.
I think he figures, well, the food was on the inside, so why should I wash the outside?
Drips.
I believe me.
I don't know.
I am all about washing the outside.
Still caught in the crossfire of like cooking, like stuff splatters. You know?
I know. It's a good thing he doesn't listen to this podcast.
I'm not that fastidious, but like, even though I know that.
But I think that in life it is doing nothing but benefiting me to be a little bit less aggressive with my scrubbing. Because it frees me up and it's also probably better for my pots and pans to not be so aggressive.
Probably. Yeah.
But I'm curious what you guys do out there. If you have, like, if you feel like you have to return your pots to sort of, like new look and feel every time you use them, or if you kind of let a exterior or interior patina build up over time.
You know what definitely has a patina in my kitchen? My sheet pans.
Yeah, I mine do, but I still scrub the heck out of them, and I need to give up a little on that because it gets insane.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just, it's my mother. I'm a scrubber because of her. My mom washes everything with the scrubby side of the sponge, which is not great because like,
does she have nonstick skillets? She really shouldn't do that.
She does. I know. I have tried to convince her. Like, she has made the coffee pots, like the glass coffee pots, cloudy from scrubbing, and I just cannot convince her. It's like she feels like it's cleaner if she scrubs.
Okay.
So, you know.
To each their own.
It's true.
Maybe someone out there has some great tip or tool.
Maybe. I look forward to hearing.
Our lives will be changed.
Or we just embrace a slightly less perfect life and be happy. So, Joy, what are you loving?
I thought this was what you were loving.
Oh, is it what I'm loving? Oh, it's been a while since I did this. I am loving parsnips.
Nothing against parsnips. I also love them.
I have a cold. It's been a while. I am loving parsnips. I have been putting them in soup. I've been roasting them.
I love a roasted parsnip.
I have to tell you, I looked at it. I was like, oh, I like parsnips. I've been really loving parsnips. I am the one who put this on the script. This time of year, to me, parsnips are just one of the unsung heroes of the winter vegetable sort of, array, because they have a lot of natural sugar. So they roast really beautifully. They're so sweet. They bring a lot to soups. They kind of almost have like a nutmeggy taste.
Yes.
That I love in like a pot of chicken soup. I know you, I think you had said a while back that you were shaving them raw and putting them in salads.
They're good raw. Yeah, indeed.
And they're just such a nice option in the winter when, you know, while there are more options out there in winter than there used to be, you know, we have a limited palate. And so why not invite a parsnip into your kitchen?
Yeah, you have to embrace the winter vegetables, I think, if you want to keep. And I think being plant-based has like really opened my eyes to this, because like that's a big part of what I'm eating. So I will take any variations that I can get.
Well, and they're super creamy. They make a really good soup. Like,
saute. You can also like mix them with your potatoes for mashed potatoes, and they really bring something like a mashed potato and parsnip is good.
Definitely. Absolutely. I used to make this like potato and pumpkin puree combo, but a potato and parsnip puree would also be so good. And you could add a little fresh nutmeg to really boost that flavor.
Yeah. I actually have a recipe that I dug up and we'll put in the show notes for a parsnip and maple cake.
I feel like I remember when you developed that recipe, because weren't you working on a vegetable dessert book
yes,
at one point?
I was, yes.
A proposal?
Yes.
I feel like you were ahead of the curve with that, Joy.
With all things, and to my detriment.
But yeah, that sounds so good. Parsnip maple cake. Yum. Yeah.
I was actually looking at it again to see if it could be veganized. I think it could be. But yeah, it's that nutmeggy quality that gives it like a real, it's really good in a baked good. It's like carrot cake, but better somehow.
I'll have to try it. Yeah.
It's super tasty.
I do. I just think that everybody should be eating parsnips this time of year.
Cosign.
All right.
And I think that about does it for this episode of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.